We banned cannabis forever with an international treaty, but then accepted it as a favored medication and recreation. Now, ready or not, we are building an industry on the forbidden plant. And so we ask, can a legitimate industry thrive on an illegitimate cannabis crop?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned in to the 1057th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends way over there in Fremantle who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Strubia on the boards. Hello, Jason.
It's a pleasure to roll with.
Pleasure to have you aboard as piloting in command today. Let me ask you this, Jason. Do you think we can build a legitimate industry on the illegitimate cannabis?
Yikes. I think that's a complicated one. I don't know if it's quite so straightforward.
Okay. House that's a very good answer, Jason. Way to go. And also with us today, we have a guest producer, Les Israelo. Les, welcome aboard.
Well, I'm glad to be here today.
Good. Now, you're the one who came to me and said, got to do a show on the cannabis industry.
That is correct.
And I thought, what, rolling papers in bongs? Is that what we're talking about?
No, we're not. There's an election coming up in November, and there is a ballot to have a passage of recreational marijuana in California, and it might be happening. And I wanted to know what was going on.
And there's a lot going on, it appears. And so you're bringing the luminaries, as it were, of the cannabis industry to the table today, and who are they?
They're Taylor West, Deputy Director, National Cannabis Industry Association out of Denver. Steve D'Angelo, founder of the Harborside Health Center, Oakland and San Jose. Lamar Baxter, Alternative Investments out of Sacramento and Bay Area. And Mark Goldfogel, the Fourth Corner Credit Union in Denver.
Well, we have quite a lineup for you folks, so to get your cup of coffee ready and sit down and strap on your seatbelt because it's going to get wild. We're going to talk about the wild ride of the cannabis industry, and we're going to start it off with Taylor West, who is the Deputy Director of the National Cannabis Association. Taylor, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Pleasure to have you aboard. Goodness sakes, the National Cannabis Industry Association, didn't even know there was such a thing, and now there is. What is it?
So NCIA is essentially a trade association, just like any other industry would have. This industry is now worth something like $5.7 billion. So there are...
Taylor, that's a lot of rolling papers.
It certainly is. And, you know, we have a lot of public policy issues that we have to deal with. There's obviously the fact that it remains illegal at the federal level, but there are other federal policy issues that create problems for businesses as well. So part of our role as the NCIA is to be an advocate for businesses in Washington, D.C., to get reform on some of those issues.
And you just came back from a week of lobbying in Washington, D.C., and did the Congress people smile on you?
They did. This was our sixth annual Cannabis Industry Lobby Days, and basically what that means is that we have business owners and cannabis professionals from around the country fly into D.C. We spend 2 days doing meetings all over Capitol Hill. So we had about 150 participants this year. We did about 200 meetings with congressional offices to talk about our issues. And the amazing thing about lobby days is how you can see from 1 year to the next the way the approach to these issues is evolving. It used to be we got, you know, polite chuckles, proverbial pats on the head, checking the box, having the meeting, but not really taking it seriously. That has completely changed.
Are they starting to sense the money then?
I think it's the money. I think it's their constituents. You know, there are
money and votes. That'll get their ears in Washington, right?
Absolutely. And there's a recognition that, look, these are small business owners. They're entrepreneurs. They're trying to build a legitimate responsible industry, and all that we're asking is to be treated fairly and like other businesses.
Well, I guess we always like to ask our guests who pays the way, and I guess by asking you who pays the way for the association, we'll learn pretty much what the industry is all about.
Sure. So we have about 1,000 member businesses around the country, and they each pay either monthly or annual dues to the association. So that's where our core funding comes from. And about half of our member businesses are what we call direct-to-plant businesses. So that means any business that touches the cannabis plant, cultivators, dispensaries, infused product makers. And then the other half are what we refer to as ancillary businesses. So that's any business that's supporting the industry but isn't directly handling the plant. And that's absolutely everything you can think of: packaging, equipment, lighting, attorneys, accountants, pretty much anything that any business would need, we need in the cannabis industry. So that's kind of where the other half of our membership comes from.
Taylor, what led you to become involved in the cannabis industry?
You know, I had some experience in the past working with a drug policy reform organization, so kind of coming at it from more of the policy and advocacy side. And then I spent several years working in politics or on a more campaign side, working for candidates and that sort of thing. When I moved out to Denver, I was looking around at opportunities, and I had some relationships with some folks who were involved with NCIA. And it seemed like such a fantastic way, first of all, to combine my experience with a really interesting policy issue, but also to get involved with what is by far the most interesting and exciting industry in the country right now.
There it is. It's a true growth industry, right?
That's right.
Well, let's go back. 1937, we made cannabis illegal. 1961, we locked it down forever with a single convention treaty that made it pretty much illegal forever. What is the legal status of cannabis? It seems like it varies from community to state to the federal government to the, to an international treaty in which, as I understand it, every nation in the world except for 9 signed up to prohibit cannabis forever.
Yeah, it's a very complicated situation right now with a lot of inconsistencies. At the federal level, cannabis is still considered a Schedule I controlled substance, and that makes it the most dangerous, the most prone to abuse, the least medical value, at least as the law sees it. This puts it in the same level as drugs like heroin. Interestingly, cocaine is actually Schedule II, which is one step below that. So it really is just objectively miscategorized within the federal laws, but that's where it's been for, as you point out, several decades. The change in recent years is that the federal government, the Department of Justice, has adapted their approach to say that they are deprioritizing enforcement of cannabis laws in states that have moved forward with some form of legalization.
In other words, Taylor, we're just going to ignore the law for those people that we decide to ignore the law for.
Yeah, and it sounds odd, but the reality is that in our criminal justice system, prosecutorial discretion is a pretty common thing for prosecutors to be able to decide, what makes sense to go after. This is just prosecutorial discretion on a larger scale, obviously. So essentially they said, we're going to take a hands-off approach in states that are trying this, especially if the state has laid out a regulated program. But they're going to continue to enforce certain priorities around it, things like making sure it's not moving from one state to another, making sure it's not being sold to children, making sure we're keeping international cartels out of the industry. So those priorities are still being enforced, but in general, they have said that they're taking, at least temporarily, a wait-and-see sort of approach in allowing states to move forward.
Taylor, given the unclear legal status of cannabis, can we develop a thriving industry, a legitimate industry on an illicit crop?
Well, I will tell you, we already have, to a certain extent. $5.7 billion is nothing to sneeze at. There are massive challenges that come into play in part because of this conflict between state and federal law. But because states have been allowed to move forward with their programs, we're starting to see a critical mass and an amount of momentum around changing these policies that I think are going to will keep this moving. So we already have a thriving industry. The real question is now just how quickly will it grow, and how quickly can we get the federal policy changes that will kind of remove the worst of the conflict.
Well, Taylor, thank you so much for joining us today. Taylor West, Deputy Director, National Cannabis Industry Association. Pay them your dues, folks. You deserve it.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
House plants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high value special crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Well, folks, get this. According to the Single Convention Treaty, signed in 1961 by all but 9 nations in the world, cannabis is a Class 1 narcotic. And according to Article 6 of the Constitution, and I quote, "The laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby." But they're not, because we're not paying attention to that law anymore. In a lot of states, California is considering the recreational use of cannabis, November 8th election. A lot of other states are considering it. A lot of other states have already taken the step of legalizing medical marijuana, which was the beginning of the real legal industry. And one of those people who really got things going is a man named Steve D'Angelo, who is the founder of the Harborside Health Center, author of a book. And what is the name of your book, Steve?
The Cannabis Manifesto, available on Amazon.
There you go. Now, what is the Cannabis Manifesto?
The Cannabis Manifesto, well, it's 8 chapters, each of which starts with a statement of belief that I back up with fact and science and history and political analysis. It basically lays out all of the major arguments for legalizing cannabis.
Good to go. I'd like to focus, if I can, right now on medical marijuana, because it seems like medical marijuana was really the camel's nose in the tent, as it were. Once that nose was in the tent, it was hard to keep the rest of the camel out. And now it's pretty much in. Medical marijuana is, in fact, a legitimate industry in many states, and you're certainly part of that. Tell us about Harborside Medical.
Harborside Health Center, we opened 10 years ago to serve as a gold standard for cannabis retailing, to demonstrate that this was something that could be done when it was done with good intention, in a way that brings benefits not just to our patients, but to the community that surrounds us.
And the interesting thing about it was that you were the first person, I think, that really recognized that it would help the cannabis industry if you kind of upgraded the image a little bit, picked it up a little bit, so it wasn't the kind of the downbeat image that it was carrying around for so long.
Yeah, we tried to create a retail environment that any American would feel comfortable coming into, that felt like a normal retail experience, hopefully one of your more pleasurable retail experiences.
How many customers do you have for your two clinics in your clinics in Oakland and San Jose, Steve?
We have over 220,000 registered patients. We see about 1,000 patients a day.
I'd like to ask you a personal question, which you may or may not want to answer, but I have to ask anyway. What percentage of those people consume marijuana for medical purposes, and what percent consume it for recreational purposes?
Well, you know, I don't like the terms recreational and medical because I think the vast majority of people who use cannabis use it for wellness purposes. You know, if you accept that definition, then everybody who comes to the Harborside, 100% of people are using it for wellness purposes.
So that's a good good way of answering it. You could be a politician, you know, with an answer like that. That's a good
one. You know, it's actually, you know, I think the fact when you look at the reason most people use cannabis, there's certainly people who are using it for cancer, or epilepsy,
right,
or anxiety, or depression. But there's an awful lot of people who use it to do things like extend their patience or wake up their sense of creativity or enhance the flavor of a meal or the sound of music or the touch of their lover's skin. And I think those are all legitimate wellness uses.
Who can argue with that? I don't know who can, but maybe somebody can. You know who I think probably would? In looking back at the single convention treaty, it seems to me like if I were head of a giant pharmaceutical company, I would really push for something like the single convention treaty, because it takes a plant that had been very useful to in so many ways to so many different people and takes it out of circulation and in effect makes it unavailable to anybody. And now here's Steve D'Angelo with two Harborside health centers, and you're taking care of a lot of people who are not necessarily taking pharmaceutical medications. It seems like you're robbing the till of some very powerful people there.
Well, you know, cannabis is a very safe and effective medicine, especially when compared to pharmaceuticals. You know, in the first 20 states that enacted medical cannabis laws, the rate of fatal drug overdoses from pharmaceutical painkillers dropped by 25%, saving 17,000 lives since 1996. So it is a powerful alternative to pharmaceuticals. That's absolutely true.
I'd like to back that up. I have a conversation with a good friend, a fellow Vietnam vet who was blown out of a truck in Vietnam and has been on opioids for many, many, many years. And somehow he got connected with medical marijuana, and specifically medications based on CBD instead of THC. And the last time I talked to him, he said his consumption of opioids has gone down by 75%. But what I noticed is that he was clear. He sounded like the old guy I used to know. What is it about the medical marijuana that seems to be making a transition from THC to CBD, or is it? Is it my imagination?
No, it's not your imagination, but THC and CBD are just the tip of the iceberg. It turns out that the cannabis plant has several hundred active ingredients in it, which are known as cannabinoids. THC and CBD are two of them, but there's many, many others that we don't have much experience or knowledge about yet. So our understanding of the plant is increasing by leaps and bounds every day, and we're learning that it's really a therapeutic treasure chest.
And it seems like what we've been doing for so many years is selecting cannabis for its THC content. It seems like if we start redirecting those efforts in other directions, there are perhaps so many other things that we can take that from the cannabis plant that would be so beneficial for us in other ways. And in fact, it seems like we just got a piece of the Wall Street Journal this week. A company in England, I think, is marketing a synthetic form of CBD to the medical community. So do you see this growth blossoming in medical marijuana?
Oh, yeah. You know, 20 or 25 years from now, the renaissance of medical cannabis is going to be recognized as the most important development in medicine since the discovery of germ theory. Pharmaceutical companies who once tried to keep cannabis off the market are going to be feverishly doing research and development, trying to pull out all of the many, many, many different therapeutic compounds that are in this plant. So we are just at the very beginning stages of a medical revolution.
How do you think the industry is going to justify itself with that single convention treaty that restricts cannabis to a class one narcotic?
Well, you know, the single convention treaty was based on bad science. It was largely put in place by Harry Anslinger, who was the Federal Bureau of Narcotics crusader responsible for producing films like Reefer Madness. So it's outdated. It's based on superstition and racism rather than science and logic. And like all other outdated laws and treaties that have lived past their day, it's time to shelve it.
Can we shelve it? I mean, there every nation except nine in the world is signatory to this, and we'd have to get everybody to sign off, I guess, huh?
Yeah, but you have to look at the history. So it was the United States that was responsible for encouraging the United Nations to pass the Single Convention Treaty in the first place. We are a hugely influential nation in that body. What we've seen around the world is that as the United States has reformed its cannabis laws, we've seen cannabis laws in other places like Mexico, like Portugal, Uruguay, also being changed. So it's time for the United States to do what we do and lead.
All right, Steve D'Angelo, Harborside Health Center, thank you so much for joining us today. And go out there and have a great day. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, do stay tuned. Right back with the money in cannabis. Woo! Ready or not, here it comes, a $5.7 billion a year cannabis industry based all on the illicit and illegal cannabis crop. Can that industry thrive and survive in the legal uncertainty of it being so classified by the countries of the world as a class one narcotic? That's the question on the table today. Well, one of the reasons that will certainly help it along is the money involved. And there is a lot of money. And here to talk about some of that money, we have Lamar Baxter with Alternative Investments in Sacramento, California. Lamar, welcome to The Food Chain.
Thanks for having me on.
So do you think that investments in the cannabis industry will ever become mainstream investments, or will they always be alternative investments?
Well, I think it will definitely become one of the alternatives, and just based on the political climate with a lot of states now coming online, both recreationally and medicinally, it seems like the trend is trending towards it becoming a legalized substance, or should I say a legalized investment option.
And I guess they're both almost the same thing then, right? So how did you become involved in the investment side of the cannabis industry?
Well, over the last few years, I've been contacted by my investors who are setting up self-directed retirement plans as well as using private capital looking for alternative investment options. And the cannabis industry has been one of the options that's been discussed over the last few years. And as a result of changing legislation on the state level, allowing it either medicinally and or recreationally, now more interest is actually increased to a point where now people are coming off the fence and wanting to learn more, as well as to actually make the investment either directly or indirectly into the industry.
I guess with zero interest rates, the people are looking for places to put their money so that it just doesn't evaporate. And one of those possibilities is the cannabis industry, because there's some margin there, right?
That's true.
So what kind of, I mean, I can't imagine people investing in glass bongs, but maybe that's what you're talking about, is it?
Well, there's various aspects. I've been approached by investors as well as investment promoters in the industry that are looking to make investments, whether it be directly into real estate, whether they have more of a passive investment by purchasing the land and maybe even selling it or even leasing it to an operation, all the way up to the point where they're looking to maybe invest in some of the equipment that may cultivate the crops. There's a wide range of options in investment, including investing in the dispensaries, becoming active or silent partner. there's been a lot of inquiries on all subjects, all levels of investment in that industry.
Tell us about investing in cannabis industry real estate.
Well, for example, I was up in Lake County, or the Emerald Triangle, as they call it, about a month ago, looking for some properties for a few clients of mine who are basically looking for land and or warehouse space in anticipation on what's going to happen in November. They're predicting that the legalization on the state level will pass for recreational use, so a lot of them are kind of getting a jump on the game and trying to be able to acquire land and or commercial property for cultivation.
And with respect to commercial property, if it becomes legal, won't they just be growing it out in the Central Valley and about 1 million acres of land out there?
Well, not necessarily. Some will opt to go that direction, but others also will be constructing nurseries to be able to grow it and, of course, installing top-notch security to be able to guard their crops. But, you know, I've heard a lot of different scenarios in terms of how they plan to operate. You know, it's one of those situations to where everyone has different ideas. It's relatively new, so everyone's kind of the Wild West out there in terms of different structures and options out there, but definitely the inquiries are beginning to increase.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is kind of an interesting notion if you look forward to the fact that, well, it's going to be legal. That would mean, perhaps, that you can grow it anywhere, and if you can grow it anywhere and everywhere, won't people do that? I think that's what happened to the last cannabis initiative in California, is that a lot of the people in the cannabis industry did not want it legal because that would ruin the price.
Well, what's going to happen is as it becomes legalized on both the recreational level as well as medicinal, you're basically having the local government step in and implement ordinances and rules restricting where you can grow and how much you can grow as well. So there's going to be limitations in that area as well, in conjunction with any legalization on the state level. So that's one of the challenges that I'm sure, and I'm hearing also, that a lot of municipalities are having in terms of what types of ordinances are going to construct to basically make sure there's some boundaries and where you can grow and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. And right now, of course, a lot of this is happening inside. The growing is happening inside. So people are looking for a lot of warehouse spaces and whatnot, right?
That is true. I actually have two clients now, one looking for warehouse space anywhere from 25 to 30,000 square feet in San Francisco, and the other the same in Oakland. So it's to a point where, once again, they're trying to get a head start before the prices start to skyrocket, because I'm sure if those are looking for that type of property after November and the legislation passes, the prices will begin to skyrocket in the commercial area.
Do you see a market like futures, like they have in regular crop commodities, like, you know, hogbacks and cotton and soy and things like that? Do you see something like that developing with respect to different kinds of cannabis?
I think so. If it gets legalized on the federal level, I don't see why that wouldn't be the case, because there's one thing about the industry, and, you know, I learned this a few years ago, just even based on agriculture, there's a lot of technology and different methods in terms of growing different crops. So I can imagine that being, you know, an option in terms of any other type of commodity or futures, yes.
Do you see the industry developing along the lines of wine, where we have certain areas that produce the best wine, like the Napa Valley has an appellation that's worth a lot of money all over the world? It comes from Napa Valley. It's the good stuff. But do you see the same thing happening with cannabis?
I can see that, looking at California, just kind of based on past versus present, I can see that happening in the three counties, meaning Humboldt, Lake County, and Mendocino County. Those I can see being the best areas based on climate, maybe to get the best results for its crops, based on what I'm hearing from some of the people that are actually entering the industry or getting into the industry. That I can see being an advantage, kind of like with the wine industry. Certain areas will produce the best crops.
Mm-hmm. And what about the, you know, when you're looking for warehouse space, what are some of the considerations for good warehouse space?
Well, once again, you'd have to take a look at the ordinances, because usually with the local ordinances, they're usually trying to make sure that it's in an industrial area away from schools and other traditional activities. So that's going to be a challenge, at least in the interim, but as it may open up, and that is in respect to the dispensaries. So you definitely have limitations already in place, and that's what's going to restrict the price, or should I say increase the price on warehouse space, because it's going to be limited areas to where you can actually open up shop.
Okay. Well, Lamar, you're the money guy. Looking into the future, do you think that, you know, there's going to be a thriving cannabis industry in spite of the fact that we have signed this single convention treaty relegating cannabis to a class one narcotic? Do you think we can resolve that conundrum?
I think that is the challenge right now. That's the reason why we haven't, meaning the U.S., haven't moved forward to legalize it. I mean, it's clear, you know, you look at states like Washington, Colorado, those states are thriving right now in terms of the cash and the tax revenue. But the challenge for the U.S. government is that they can't back out of that treaty, or unless other countries who will also sign on that treaty in tandem basically back out of the treaty. And I'm hearing some other countries are looking to pull out that are part of that treaty. So that might give the U.S. government the opening that they need to be able to pull out as well.
Lamar Baxter, Alternative Investment, Sacramento, California. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay tuned out there. We're going to pick up the Mark Goldfogel and the money. The money. Where did the money go? Right back. Ready or not, it is here. A $5.7 billion a year industry based on the illegitimate cannabis crop. Holy smokes, that's a lot of cash, and a lot of it is cash. How does all of that work? Well, we're going to find out with Mark Goldfogel, who is the founder of the Fourth Corner Credit Union in Denver. Mark, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm not the founder of it. Credit unions don't have founders.
Oh.
Credit unions belong to our members. And so the people who are the founders and creators of the credit union will be everyone who joins the credit union once we're able to open and service the industry.
So you haven't quite not open for business yet.
We are not open for business yet, and very much deliberately so.
Okay. So here we have a $5.7 billion a year industry. You know, people take some seeds and they put them in the ground and they grow the plants up and they get a couple thousand dollars for the plant. And so they're running around they don't sell these things on Bank AmeriCards, do they?
Nope. They don't sell them on Bank AmeriCards, and depending upon the state and how deeply within some sort of structure they're operating, they don't sell it for anything but cash that likely never shows up on anybody's books, in anybody's taxes, or is regulated in any way.
Okay, so is that part of the $5.7 billion a year industry then, or is it different from that industry that we were told about earlier in the show?
So the amazing thing about cannabis, and you heard about this earlier, is there's two industries running simultaneously. There's the developing legal market industry that is state regulated, that has taxes, that has oversight, and that involves a paradigm that I helped create called seed-to-sale tracking. And that's where the $5.7 billion, which has actually been up to about $7.2 billion is the latest estimate for this year, that's where that money is coming from. All of that money is taking place in a way that local municipality, that state, has sanctioned the transaction, is attempting to tax the transaction, as regulating the way it's grown, the way it's sold, the way it's distributed. Every aspect of the industry in those states are regulated. And that's that money that we're talking about now. We're not talking about the guy that you know, grows in his basement and just sells you an ounce or
so
brings in some great California.
We're kind of
wheat.
Talking on the tip of that 5.7, then, is really the tip of the iceberg.
Yes, it's barely the tip of the iceberg. It's not even. We don't really know how big the iceberg is, because most of the businesses that buy and sell marijuana, or people that buy and sell marijuana illegally, aren't going to be reporting that.
How does it work?
This is all reportable.
How does it work? What's the transition from the illegal grower to the legal clinic or seller? How does that work?
Well, the first step is your state has to have regulations to abide by. This entire industry is built out of the premise that the difference between an illegal drug dealer and a legal licensed business is whether they're following regulation. Well, if there are no regulations, if you're in Kentucky and you're buying and selling marijuana, there are no regulations for how to do that legally. And so there is no such thing but the black market there, and there's no need to declare your taxes. There's no need to talk about the business you're in, because all it will do is get you arrested. But if you're in a state like Colorado that has incredible incredibly deep, intricate, detailed regulations for everything you do from the time the plant is planted until the candy bar is sold, then the way that you achieve legitimacy is you own and you adore and you follow those regulations with every breath you've got, because those are the regulations that establish your legitimacy.
Hmm. I hate to say it, but I think I like Kentucky best.
You might, and certainly the state of California has enjoyed living in an environment that was pseudo-regulated, pseudo-illegal since 1996.
Right.
But the problem with that is, if in fact you can't justifiably demonstrate that you are following the guidelines to the full extent of whatever regulatory authority is giving you those guidelines, then you've got a much harder time justifying that what you're
doing deserves the protection. Then the industry can't really legitimize itself, become mainstream. So what are you doing with the credit union to help facilitate this legalization of an illegal industry?
I'm going to back up one step, because the credit union is just the last step in, for me, what has been an 8-year process. And each step of this has been a little bit further down the food chain, but it's all had the same purpose: legitimize this industry. How do you legitimize the industry? The first thing you've got to do is control the growth and sale of the product. And that's where I helped develop a paradigm called seed-to-sale tracking, which is used by a number of point-of-sale systems in the industry. I helped build one of them, mm-hmm. and a number of others have come along. And what that says is that every plant that is grown in the industry, let's take for the state of Colorado, is tracked and regulated how much was harvested from it, what the waste of it was, and how much could be sold of it, so that the state can justify that their program is not shipping tons of marijuana across state lines into illegal states, so that the state can validate that this program that's so important for our tax revenue can be justified.
Mark, can you hold? Mark, we're going to have to take a quick break. Can you hold on?
No problem.
Because we'll have a few minutes left to finish up, but it's getting interesting. So please do stay tuned,
folks.
This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're talking about the cannabis industry, and specifically, we're asking: can a legitimate industry thrive on an illegitimate cannabis crop? Which seems to be exactly what it's doing. It seems to be getting along just fine without anybody's help. But can we? What would happen if it was really, truly legal? Would it blossom like crazy? Would it go into this period of fluorescence? And is it possible to make it legal, given that we signed a convention, a treaty against it? Right back. Welcome back. Michael Olson, Food Chain Radio Show. This one produced by Les Israelo about the cannabis industry. We're finishing up with the conversation about the money, all the money, and how do we manage the money. And we have Mark Goldfogel with us from the Four Corner Credit Union, a credit union in development designed specifically to serve the industry when and if the industry is legal enough to be served, I guess. Is that right, Mark?
Well, of course, that is the million-dollar question. We're at a gray line here where we've got 24 states who have said, yes, this industry can be served and it needs to be served, and we want the tax revenue and we want patients to have access, or in five of those cases, anybody to have access. And now the question becomes, how do we safely get that money into our financial systems and under control? Anybody who's ever watched The Godfather understands what mafia can do and what that illegal and cartel activity is capable of. And anybody that's ever studied the end of alcohol prohibition sees the relationship between the end of alcohol prohibition and the rise of that whole gangster mentality. And none of us want to have that repeat. So we all have a vested interest in making sure this happens legitimately. The problem is that the wheels of politics turn slowly, and the wheels of banking tend to follow the wheels of politics.
You just brought up something that just kind of rang my bell. Will it be possible for government or industry or anybody to control cannabis if it becomes legal? I mean, it's a plant that loves to grow.
And sure. So's a grapevine. So's hops.
Mm-hmm.
Hops is a very invasive, very widely growing plant. and we've managed to control and regulate beer. Tobacco is a wildly growing plant. We've managed to regulate nicotine, although in some people's opinions, perhaps not to the level it should be. And today we have technology that we didn't have when alcohol was allowed. We didn't have when tobacco was rolling out. We have the technology today to say every single plant that's grown for this industry, we as a government, we as an agency, can track and regulate and make sure that it's not getting into the hands of cartels and make sure that it's not getting in the hands of children.
Well, I understand that we can, you know, control the people that are in the industry. But I'm thinking about, you know, all the people out there that love to grow tomato plants in their backyard. And, you know, if cannabis is worth so much, and what's to stop all those people who love to grow tomato plants from planting some seeds themselves and thus, you know, kind of raising havoc with the price of cannabis?
Well, I mean, let's again go back to the beer analogy. What is the price of people buying home brewery kits and brewing their own beer?
Mm-hmm.
What is or making their own moonshine? And they can do it today, and there's certain rules and guidelines as far as what.
Well, that's
they
because
can do
you can buy a 6-pack of beer for a few bucks, right?
That's right.
But cannabis is like what, thousands of dollars in a pound?
But you don't use a pound.
Yeah.
So it's and that price is predominantly driven by the fact that it's still a pseudo illegal industry. So when you come to Colorado, where we've gotten these regulations and we've built large grows, it's not uncommon at all here to find marijuana at $100, $125 an ounce, where just a few years ago it was over $400 an ounce.
Ah, so the price is coming down.
Oh, of course. And as supply and demand go, and certainly as California brings on its regulated market, I believe that's going to drop the price of cannabis everywhere in the country.
Mark, out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Mark Fogle, the Fourth Corner Credit Union, Les Israelo. What do you think, bud? Are we going to be able to keep this business going?
I think so. There's just too much money involved.
Too much money involved. There it is. Folks, thanks for tuning in. File this one under Michael Olson's third law of the food chain. Cheap food isn't.
Been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.